So tune in, turn on, and go off. All day, the 8th of March, listen to 855 AM 3CR Community Radio, Women Rockin' the Airwaves.
Hello and welcome to this International Women's Day special. You're here with us at 3CR and this is the Trans Party Hour. My name's Regan and I'm joined in the studio with Lisbeth.
Hi.
And today we've got a very special lineup. I've arranged two interviews, one with Amor, who's a Fafafina, who was joining me from the festivities at the Mardi Gras, and Baxi, who was speaking to me from Mildura. So the two of them have some particular insights into, I guess, experiences of womanhood, that differ from many that are being expressed elsewhere. And it's great to be able to celebrate the diversity of women on this special day. And next up, we have a track called Forever by an artist, Crazy Bitch in a Cave. Welcome back to Trans Party Hour. You're here on 3CR with Regan and Lisbeth, and we're going to be talking about role models that we've had in our life. First of all, shout out to all the wonderful trans women that we have in our life, and trans femmes and trans feminine folk. But I wanted to ask Lisbeth what your experience has been with role models. Who do you look up to?
That's a good question. I think that I've always had lots of strong women in my life, starting very early. So and some of them I didn't really get to know very well because of circumstance. So I guess the first role models were my mother and my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who went to university at the age of 16 in the 1920s as an Irish working class woman in Western Australia, which is profoundly amazing to me, and shows some real strength. I did a lot of work in my early 20s with the Indonesian student movement and labour movement, and I met some amazingly strong women through that experience that profoundly changed my life. And some historical figures as well that I've always looked up to. But also, I think that in terms of trans women, I think that before I started to question my gender identity, I hadn't met a lot of trans women, and so it's only after I got I started that process that I started to explore. And so obviously people like Sylvia Rivière are incredibly important figures and inspiring people, but I think almost all trans women that I've met have been strong and brave and beautiful human beings in their own reigns. I wouldn't necessarily say that I was friends of all the trans women that I've met, but they've all been people who have had an element that I'd like to emulate, I think. That's a very long response.
Yeah, no, that's great. I run a workshop on trans misogyny and femphobia last year, and we started the exercise by going around the room and asking people who their femme idol was. And so there were lots of pop stars, there's lots of Beyonce and like all of those kind of things. And my mum was actually at the workshop with me. And I said, my femme idol's my mum, and she's here today, and she's been supporting me in my transition, and I really love her. And the whole room just melted. It was quite hilarious. But I think that there are those role models that we have in our lives, which are incredibly important. A friend of mine was talking about how the lack of strong women in the media was something that affected her, who growing up didn't really have role models, certainly didn't have trans role models, but also didn't have strong women to identify with. And so what are you then left with?
I think you explore. So some of the things are the historical figures. So like someone like Rosa Luxemburg, who's a Polish revolutionary, a German revolutionary, is really important to me. But I think it is changing now. There are so many more trans women in the media, which is really positive. It's quite a diverse range of trans women as well. And almost every day we're hearing of more and more people who are coming out, as trans, which means that I think that for people growing up now, I guess I'm still growing up, but I'm a lot further into my growing up process than a lot of other people, that there are people who they will, that makes it, there's people they can look to and say, well, that's an experience which seems something close to what I'm going through, and it's not this strange, I'm not the only person in the world who's experiencing that. And I think that that's probably the most hopeful thing at the moment for me, is that like, there's lots of transphobia and there's lots of transmisogyny still in the world. So much, and you just look at the statistics, you can see that, but there's really positive signs that their shifts are happening.
Yeah. One group that I've been part of, which is really good for supporting young, gender diverse and trans people, is Y-Gender, which is Melbourne based. Other states, I think, aren't always so fortunate to have such strong youth groups, but there are groups around, and it's just a matter of getting online and finding them. There's also Transgender Victoria, which, of course, Sally Goldner is involved in, and Sally Goldner's weekly show, Out of the Pan, whose slot we're taking today because she's on holiday, so definitely having a well-earned rest. I guess The other thing that that comes up for me is thinking about how people support you in transitioning, how people can be allies with trans people, and how they can make the transition, which can be a very difficult process with a lot of people experiencing mental illness in relation to. Not only gender dysphoria and bodily dysphoria, but with the way that they're then treated in society. I've heard anecdotally people talk about really high rates of homelessness with trans kids being kicked out of home, and that these things are completely unreported because obviously when people are seeking housing support, they don't then go in and say, what's your sexual orientation? What's your gender? And is this the reason why you're being kicked out of home? On the one end of the spectrum, there's people who end up with not a great deal of support, and are then seeking to find groups, seeking to find a community of people who can pull them through this. And then on the other end of the spectrum, people who are wonderfully supported, whose families might not entirely understand. But offer support in really important ways by, you know, providing that reassurance that we still love you. That's a really big thing. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, my experience is probably somewhere in the middle of those things. I started to question my identity in my late 20s, early 30s. And so I had a job. I had a secure job. I wasn't out at work, and I wasn't talking to people at work, largely talking to people at work about that. This was in Western Australia, but I was part of, I guess, a queer scene, which was initially very supportive, but they had very weird expectations about what it meant to be to transition, and so there was all this pressure to be trans in a particular way. And that, for a range of reasons, that didn't fit what my sense of who I was as a woman was, and what I needed to do to be a woman, and so that caused tensions. I then moved to Victoria over 3 years ago, I came here, and there was people who knew me here as Elizabeth, and there was people in my work and other places who knew me as my birth name. And that became a tension because those two worlds started to meet, and how do you make those two worlds meet properly? And so we had a gradual process of my partner and I of letting people know that I was Elizabeth. And then that became a tension because you had people who were at work and knew me as Elizabeth and wanted to be supportive, but then were like, but if I call you Elizabeth at work, that's going to get really awkward. And so... and my work colleagues have been very supportive. I work for a union, and so particularly the women at my workplace have been super supportive and embracing and welcoming. And were very helpful in having the confidence to come out fully at work. And so I am Lisbeth at work now. But that's the thing that lots of people can't do. And even though there's all that support there for me, because of the nature of my work, I meet new people every day. And for the first 3 months of being Lisbeth at work, picking up the phone was a terrifying experience, because I just didn't... My voice, anyone who's listening will know that my voice is very deep. It's a very masculine voice. They would be picking up a phone, they'd be looking, they'd get Lisbeth would pop up on their... on their phone, because most of the calls were coming through an internal system, and the voice on the other end of the phone did not match with Lisbeth. And so every time I had those phone conversations, I had a panic attack for 3 months, which is really intense. And every time I met a new group of people, I had a panic attack. So the first 3 months of being out at work were super intense. And so I can only imagine what it would be like for people who had less support than I had.
I was quite surprised to read in one of the reports that was released, kind of showing statistics about mental illness and experiences of discrimination, of the number of trans people who aren't out at work and actually go to work in dress which doesn't really fit their gender expression, which doesn't really show who they are. But that's actually an important part of getting by, and it's what they need to do to survive. And I think that is a reality for some people is really sad, but that we need to be supportive of the ways that people have complicated relationships with coming out and with being out, that it's not always safe to be out. And that's a reality of what we face. Yeah,
definitely. I think you need to do what's safe for you.
Yeah.
I dress fairly mask at work. I've worn a dress to work once, and that was before I was out. We had a colleague was doing Frocktober, and so we had a work a day where all the staff came in together, and we decided that everyone should frock up, and so I frocked up, which went really down. Like, there was people who knew what was going on, but they were very supportive and were keen to make sure it was safe. But there were other people who didn't quite know what was going on and thought it was like a football end of year type thing, because, you know, that's their that's their experience of that. But and it's not just clothes. Facial hair can be a big issue. I've been trying to get rid of my facial hair for a while. I have complications around that, but it also means that I have real problems with ingrown hairs, and so I've got lots of lesions on my face at the moment, and so a daily part of my life is going to work with large holes in my face, which is really intense. It was intense before I transitioned, but now it's even more so because some days I can't shave, and so that I'm Lisbeth with this straggly, weird beard, and that's in terms of this dysphoria for me, the biggest part of dysphoria for me has been my relationship with facial hair. It's a huge source of distress for me, and for other people, there's other elements of that as well. But I think that it's really important that that people are able to be themselves in whatever way they are, but also that their sense of who they are as a woman, or where they lie in within the spectrum, is a very personal thing, and that shouldn't be policed and judged on.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's kind of coming more into recognition is distinctions between concepts of someone's gender identity as being male or female or non-binary, and their gender expression as being particularly feminine or femme or butch or mask or masculine. That those things aren't necessarily matched, and they don't need to be. And it's something where femme trans guys can experience very similar experiences of discrimination as femme trans women, as femme cis women. And so what it kind of seems to come down to is that masculinity is always seen as superior to femininity, whoever is displaying, expressing that.
Yeah. Mm. And that's central to Julia Serrano's work around transmisogyny,
yeah.
is that the idea that masculinity is inherently superior.
Yeah. So Julia Serrano is a trans author who has written some amazing stuff and has really been foundational in talking about trans feminism. And one of the things she talks about is two different types of sexism, oppositional sexism and binary sexism. So she talks about the opposition between masculinity, femininity, male and female, and how they're constructed as opposites, that they're not constructed independently. So in saying that, it means that women don't have the ability necessarily to create identities in isolation from men. They're always created as opposites. I recently read something that was talking about how there was kind of a point where feminism hit a brick wall. In celebrating femininity, it needed to create this idea of what it was to be a woman. But then it kind of comes to a point where it's like, well, how do you define it? How do you define it without putting limitations on women as to what they're meant to be?
Mm.
And I think a lot of that stuff that was happening in the 80s and 90s around celebrating women's bodies and celebrating cis women's bodies in particular, and talking about goddesses, talking about fertility, Mother Earth, all of those things, I think are really great notions that are applicable to some people, but they're certainly not applicable to all people, and they can create categories which are really constraining and don't allow people to be who they really are.
And definitely becomes this thing about an alternative. I mean, it's just an alternative problematic framework. It's a confining framework. You've shifted the frame, but in order to include more a group of people, you've excluded others, and so we need to have a thing which is just doesn't seek to exclude. So rather than being exclusionary, it's about inclusion. So trying to bring in people on the basis that they want to be within that framework. Mm. I was actually thinking when you were talking about that, about another feminist theorist from an earlier period around, was French theorist Lucie Rigoureux, who talks about the binary character of thinking. And so she talked about women as being not men and the problem of thinking about that. I mean, she saw that as inherently male way of thinking, but I think I don't think it's quite so gendered in terms of how people think about that.
I'm going to play a song, but when we come back, I've got a really great piece to read that comes from Kate Bornstein, which is her view of how God created Adam and Eve, and how where we went wrong was in creating binaries. So that's a really interesting one. But before that, I'll play a track. It's called Head on Vacation by Anna and Kate. Welcome back to Trans Party Hour. You're here with Regan and Lisbeth, and we're talking all things trans on this International Women's Day, celebrating trans women. There's so much that we have to cover today. One thing that I wanted to share with people was an interview that I did with Baxi, James Bax, who lives in Mildura, and spoke to me earlier in the week about instances of support and some negative experiences that she'd had with mental health workers.
My name is James Batts. I'm a transgender male to female. That's how I identify. I'm not too busy at the moment. I'm mostly just seeing mental health workers and stuff to help me out. At first, I came out to my best friend and then a few other people. And then about a few months down the track, I decided to come out to basically everyone I knew via Facebook and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I had nothing but support from absolutely everyone, even people I was certain wouldn't take it too well.
Mm.
So I was quite happy and relieved about that.
Yeah, and what kind of support were people giving to you?
Just people saying I'm still always going to be the same person they know and love, and yeah, just they'll always be there.
Really beautiful.
It's nice.
Yeah, and that was important for you in...
It was a big relief. It just made things feel so much easier for me.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I had a similar experience, and I think it's the way that many people come out to a larger group of people and people in their extended networks is to post something on Facebook and then everyone knows.
Yeah, that's it.
And also having this really surprising experience of people being incredibly supportive, even if they don't fully understand, at least extending that support.
Yeah, it's what matters. It really helps, like, to feel better about yourself, basically. But there was one worker I had at my community health centre, mm-hmm. and she was a major help to get me through a lot of stuff. But I've been seeing the actual mental health department for a while,
mm-hmm.
and it just hasn't been the best experience, that's what I can say.
Yeah. Are you generally someone who comes out to mental health workers readily, or is it something that you've been wary of talking about?
It was hard to do that first. Like, I really found it hard to get to that spot where I would go to a health worker, like, just to get help. With the health workers I've been seeing, they show support and that, but they don't really show that they've put any effort into researching or just knowing about how to address trans stuff.
Mm.
And it makes it for some painful and awkward situations.
Yeah. What particular things do you think that they're missing?
Some of the most critical things I can think of is, well, they kind of addressed it as, I decide to be a girl instead of just, this is how I am.
Okay.
And to trans people, that can be really hurtful. Yeah, it's like saying you decide to be gay or anything like that.
Yeah, that it's a really frivolous choice rather than a very deep felt sense of who you are.
Exactly.
Mm. Yep. And in these conversations, how have you responded when you've been faced with these huge misunderstandings?
Typically, I just try to let it slide in that. But at one point, she was trying to say she was really compassionate, and then she just proved that she hadn't basically learned anything, and just it really hurt, and I just left because I didn't want to get angry.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really difficult thing.
It is.
So you've had a mix of experiences, of both positive and negative experiences with mental health workers.
Yeah.
With your positive experiences, have they been with people who have a greater understanding of transgender people?
No, she actually had no idea about it, basically, when we first started talking that. She only had the rough concept about it. And she put a lot of effort into finding out stuff and contacted a lot of people and learned a lot about it.
Hmm. That's great. So yeah. It was something of an attitude of openness and wanting to support you?
Yeah.
Hmm. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. And I think that's quite hopeful also, that perhaps we can't expect that mental health support workers will be knowledgeable about this stuff if they don't have access to the information. But at least if they're willing, then they can be supportive and they can learn what they need to know to be supportive.
Yeah. That's exactly it. They need just the little things can actually really help, like just putting in a little bit of effort of research, really.
And maybe it'd be really interesting to hear about your gender journey. So when you began transitioning and perhaps what brought you to that point?
Well, it was a few months after I accepted it and that I actually found some help through a support group, and I got put in contact with a specialist in Cairns who helped me get onto hormones, which I've been on for about 8 months now. And it's just, as soon as I started the journey, like, I could already feel myself feeling better. It's just made me feel like I'm actually myself now.
Yeah.
Like, it actually makes me feel like I am who I am.
Yeah. And that's such an important thing, which perhaps is underestimated by some people who talk about hormones as something which is a really radical change, and something that perhaps is a decision which needs to be carefully restrained, and there needs to be a lot of gatekeeping around that. I think what people often don't understand is that hormones can save people's lives.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that access to treatments is really critically important for people's mental health.
Yeah, and in most cases, it's actually really hard. You need to see a number of specialists to get, like, diagnosed or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes it hard for a lot of other people. I was really lucky.
Yeah, so did you have a fairly smooth process of going through a diagnosis and getting treatment?
Yeah, I had a really long discussion with the specialist, and he saw everything because that's basically his specialty, and he understood.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I guess that just goes to show how important it is to have qualified specialists who... can understand transgender issues and understand the importance of providing treatment.
But I think more than anything, there's need for support in rural areas especially, because for some people, they have to travel to basically Melbourne like once a month or something to get their prescription, to get their medication. And that's just too tough on people.
And it's not as if transgender people only exist in urban areas.
Yeah.
We're everywhere, all over the place.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
Even in places you don't expect.
Yeah,
and
all over the world.
So you're living in Mildura at the moment?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so
Northwestern Victoria.
Yeah, so it's quite a journey for you if you need to travel to Melbourne.
Yeah. So basically, I can keep in touch with my specialist in Cairns if I need help or sort for anything. So, and I've got a GP I've been seeing for a year here now, who's fully aware and helping with the situation.
I was reading Blues to Rainbows. It was a report that was put out by Beyond Blue, and they were discussing the rates of particularly depression and anxiety among transgender people. Have you heard that report?
I haven't heard the report, but I understand.
Yeah, because this is our experience, right?
It
showed that there was actually 50% of trans women who were surveyed in this report were experiencing depression.
Yeah.
And those rates are really, compared to the general population, completely off the charts. And the need to support trans people in general, but particularly trans women, seem to have a particularly high rate of depression and anxiety, seems to me to be incredibly important.
Yeah, I can understand that it would be a high rate since there's a lot people go through.
I was speaking to James Bax, who's an MTF trans person from Mildura, and we were speaking about experiences with mental health professionals. And I was quoting a study that was put out by Beyond Blue that was particularly looking at the mental health impacts on trans communities. And I brought in a few different reports which discuss statistics related to trans people. One of them is called Private Lives, which was seeking to be an LGBT survey. I don't think there was an I in there. I think there's a bit of a disclaimer about I was a bit too hard. My impression was that the T was also a bit too hard for people who were doing that report. And the ways that trans people were categorised in that report were problematic in a bunch of ways. Firstly, that they were binary, that they were using tables where they were trans male and trans female people, so referring to transness in relation to sex, but also excluding non-binary people. And also that there's actually no reference to cisgender people that's recognisable. So trans people are seen as not male or not female. So the four categories they use in a lot of the tables are male, female, trans male, trans female. Lisbeth, did you want to talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, I actually was looking at this report recently because I was putting together some educational materials from my work around gender and sexuality. Gender and sex and sexuality, but mainly gender and sex. And I was looking at it and was very confused because I didn't know what trans male referred to and what trans female referred to. I was very worried about that. And the actual report doesn't define it anywhere. They're just used as these categories. But I think I worked it out because there's a table in there, which I can't find right now, which talks about accessing particular medical procedures, particularly pap smears and mammograms. And the trans male category has not as high as the female category, but a relatively high number of accessing of pap smears, which made me think that trans male meant trans men and that trans female meant trans women. But it's not clear, so I might be wrong, but that was my my impression because... But the impact of those categories is problematic on a range of levels, in addition to what you were talking about, which is that if I was doing the research, I wouldn't know whether or not the people who'd actually responded knew what the categories meant because most people don't use trans male and trans female to refer to... Like, I don't know anyone who uses those terms. No. So if I was looking at it, I'd be going, well, I'm a trans male. I was born... I was assigned male at birth, but I'm trans. And the use of male and female is highly problematic in my view because of the connection it has to the discourse of trans erasing radical feminists who have shifted away from discussing women and men for the exclusion of trans women to just talk about maleness and femaleness and are very... definitive in that trans women are males and so therefore should be excluded and their gender identity as women should be ignored. So I'm actually quite keen to try and talk to the people who put the report together to say what's going on.
That this obviously didn't come from the community. And I think that there are discussions in the community about better developing language which expresses better people's identities and... I have seen discussions where people have used trans male and trans female, the reason being that when people's gender expressions don't necessarily match the gender that they identify with. So, for example, butch women talking about being trans female but masculine. But this isn't something which is widely used in the community, and I think when this language has been used, there's been discussions where perhaps that isn't appropriate for a lot of people, and... that we've got a long way to go in fully developing the language that we use. And I think that's why it's particularly important that when people do research about trans people, that they're working with those communities to understand what is actually current, what are people using to describe themselves.
Yeah, definitely. And there's also historically been issues in other aspects of research, particularly around HIV, where historically trans women were included in the research as gay men. Which doesn't reflect any sort of reality of people's identity, which has meant that in lots of ways, trans women have not engaged because it's hostile. It's a hostile research, which doesn't actually seek to include them, and so they've not engaged at all in large ways in that research. But also, you wouldn't be able to know what that engagement is because they're not being included based on who they are as people.
I think this comes from a myth, which is actually really heterosexist, that trans women are actually just really, really gay men. They're so gay that they need to be women, and which is kind of just reimposing this mandatory heterosexuality that if you're attracted to men that much, then you probably want to be a woman.
Yes, and it's very erasing of trans women who are primarily attracted to women. They just don't exist, except for in the dystopic nightmares of TERFs, where trans women's identities is purely in order to gain access to particular groups of women.
And there's been really, really nasty stuff. If you've ever been on the internet and looked into the things that people write about trans women, then you probably encountered some of those nasty things. And perhaps we don't have to talk about those right now.
No.
I think what we will do is I'll share with you an interview that I did with Amor, who's a Fafafine, who's celebrating at Mardi Gras at the moment. And I've got two sections of this interview, and I'll just play the first one now.
My name is Amal. I identify as Fafafine, which is the Samoan term for transgender. Transgender as in transgender female. With myself, what do I do? I work in an employment agency as a part-time receptionist. And yeah, just up there for the community. My interest is multicultural issues that face people from transgender backgrounds. So that's my take on things.
And you're at Mardi Gras this weekend. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, Mardi Gras, the parade was amazing. It was just like, you know, people being proud of who they are at the end of the day. And so it was great to see a culmination of people, you know, gays, lesbians, transgender and straight people, to have that alliance, you know, and have people... that support that was there, it just, it was this feeling, it was, you know, quite euphoric that, you know, to be there, just was so amazing. And that support that was there, you know, people queuing up to get to certain parts in the parade where, you know, they wanted to view, it was just like, wow, this is amazing. And what I feel for, you know, like for myself and the journey that I have come to the person that I am today, it just added that touch that it's okay to be you. It's okay to, you know, live as your true self, or whatever it may be, and have these awesome people that have just there to support and say that it's okay to be who you are. And, yeah, it's just, you know, that, just that feeling. I've been to 6 Mardi Gras. I have walked in 3. And just that feeling of being unified with, you know, and this is not just with our own transgender community, gays and lesbians, or straight people, but also people from around the world who, you know, come to Sydney, you know, for the party, but also the parade. You know, it's just like, everybody's eyes are on Sydney. A wonderful feeling. Wonderful feeling.
What a great time.
Yeah, it was.
I wanted to ask, was there a large Fafafine contingent at Mardi Gras?
It was kind of split because it's a bigger... The community here in Sydney is great. You know, it's a bigger... It's a bigger state. So with the Fafafine that I knew, they were all kind of participating in different things. You know, some of them were participating in floats. Some were, you know, were watching the thing. So it was kind of hard to kind of geographically find out who's doing what from my own Samoan sisters. And so... you know, hopefully in future years, then, you know, be an interest of getting a Fafafine float, you know, tapping on resources or, you know, or our communities from the different Pacific Island groups, such as Samoa, American Samoa, Tonga, you know, with their trans girls, Whakalaitis, or, you know, from Tahiti. What I feel it would do with this, the way we, like, just a cultural thing in Pacific Island culture, we treat everybody as family. So the mental issues are very low. It's because we tend to we tend to laugh at everything. We sing, we dance, you know, that beautiful word of food. You know, we enjoy eating. So when we can combine the three and then have a group of people who just laugh, It's got to be great. So, you know, what makes me proud to be Fafafine is that when that identity of myself comes to the foreground and people see it and think, wow, look at them. They're being who they are. They enjoy who they are and they're having fun. And so my sisters, my transgender sisters from my own culture, we laugh at everything. You know, they say everything, you know, for some people it's about the physical, but for us it's also about the mental and the spiritual. Not necessarily religious, but the fact that you can have a heart to be accepting or, okay, I don't get on with you, but that's okay, I respect your views, and we will learn to work through, you know, we will learn to work through stuff, or we will learn to work through our journey, and hopefully just, you know, just try to be happy at the end of the day, you know? But yeah, just the Fafafine community is very strong, you know, in my own culture, but in my own, in the countries, you know, both Samoa and American Samoa. And it's always been there. And so, you know, when we talk about celebrating for us, it's celebrating who we are and also our foremothers, you know, our foremother transgender, you know, ladies that have gone before us, but also our own mothers and our own sisters and our nanas that have gone before us. It's a thing to celebrate, and we celebrate it on a constant basis because we tend to love our gatherings, whether they be on a social level or whether they be on a church, you know, for our elderly females, you know, that congregate within their church. You know, we see that as our community focal point because it's the bringing of a group of people together where they're able to share ideas, communicate ideas, and laugh and, you know, have fun. And so being able to celebrate that on, you know, this wonderful occasion of, you know, Women's Day, it's like, wow, right? Awesome.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I wanted to ask... from what I understand, in Australia, the First Nations people have communities of sister girls and brother boys, which come from a long and rich heritage of people's own concepts of transgenderness, which predates Western concepts of transgender. But there's been a really negative impact of colonialism on people who identify in those ways and the importation of homophobia and transphobia through missionaries, through education, and through the whole system which broke down Indigenous ways of relating. I was wondering whether for Fafafine there is a similar relationship with colonialism or what changes have occurred over time.
Community, we're very, very fortunate that it's, you know, it's just one of those cultures where it's able to have been embraced even in, you know, the so-called Christian, what you call it, take on things. It's one of the cultures where religion and gender don't seem to be in constant conflict like, you know, that is seen in Western culture. So there's not been so much an impact for Fafafine from the colonization. I think in the culture, as Samoan culture, there has. When I say that, I mean, you know, the things where we've had to, you know, like even things such as dress and stuff. I mean, you know, once upon a time, our woman would be breasted. You know, so when this European settlers, you know, came into the Pacific, you know, it was the thing that we had to adopt the stress sense that, you know, you had to be dressed a certain way or covered a certain way, which wasn't a cultural thing for us because, as I said to you before, there was the bare-breasted woman. And so there's a term that there was a thing that, you know, once upon a time, that in Samoa, they would use the cloth of the umbrellas, and we call them tiputa, and that would basically be a cloth that would cover the, you know, at once upon a time, that was a, you know, that umbrella cloth was a cloth that they, you know, had used to cover the top parts. So that's coming back to that idea of where, you know, the missionaries, you know, had an impact with Pacific people because they brought in some of these ideas, you know, and their beliefs. Even things like church, for say, you know, we have this connection to, you know, like the indigenous people, to, you know, Mother Earth, or, you know, or for us it was like God of the Sea, Tangaloa. And so this concept of, when the missionaries came, they came with their Bible, they came with their, you know, their belief of, you know, the white Christian God belief. And so that also had a big impact on, the pushing of ideals and beliefs of a Western, you know, of a colonized culture into Samoa, but also into a lot of the other Pacific nations. As I was saying to you before, with Fasafine, they really haven't done anything, although there's kind of been in the past, that there has been interest, you know, when the white settlers came, that there's in past Hawaii or Tahiti, the Ma'us, that there were stories that there were some of the sailors that would have, ongoing relations or connections with transgender women from Tahiti or Hawaii. But in terms of changing the culture of, I'll speak on Fafafine, it hasn't changed much. What Fafafine have done for themselves is that they've become a lot more stronger in terms of being visible out there. So we have young teens or youth that, you know, identify as Fafafine. And they're so proud of who they are. They're so, it's like they're able to live in their skin. I think one of the interesting things is it comes into that thing of, you know, in American Samoa, they have the American system, so they're able to go to the States for that to access, you know, the hormones. Whereas in Samoa itself, once upon a time, Western Samoa, they don't have that luxury of the hormones. Well, it's an interesting one because it's that thing where you've got those that are on the hormones and those that aren't, but people are allowed to live of who they want to be. And at the end of the day, it kind of moves away from the, you know, mentally, you know, pushing that issue of physical, when, you know, I think personally, if you can be able to get the mental situation sorted out, I think the physical is a compliment. But it's the two countries where, you know, you've got the Western push of, you can come to Hawaii or the States and do the hormones. It's just that they're very fortunate in having that American support there. But in terms of the culture of Fafafine, it's there. It's a strong culture. It hasn't had any push from colonization whatsoever. It's just the fact that we've had to deal with the colonization as a cult, as a culture in general. But as for Fafafine, we just seem to have grown, and it's, you know, coming back to that comment that I said about our foremothers who, you know, had set, you know, the precedents for us, you know, for Fafafine to come forth and to live in their light. And it will always, you know, it's one of the funniest things. It's almost like you mentioned that word Fafafine, it's just like part of the furniture. You know, and it's met with teams of endearment. They're not laughing at you. They're laughing with you.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a beautiful thing to have. So, in terms of Western, not so much as Fafafine culture, as a culture itself, general culture itself, yes. But for Fafafine, you know, because they've always been there, you know. And so the numbers now are just like, you know, massively big. But what I've realised, the difference between here and there, is the mental challenges are quite heavy here. In the Pacific, they're not, because they said, I think there's more, you know, there's more things to focus on than somebody, the way somebody dresses or the way somebody presents. You know, they've got more, you know, there's more to be concerned about than somebody, you know, dressing that may look different to what someone else is dressing. So,
yeah.
The culture for Fafafine is very strong. And it comes back to that thing about family. We treat everybody as family. So when Fafafine get together, we're seen as community providers within our own families as well. And so it's a blessing. It's a beautiful blessing because, you know, you don't need to validate who you are. They know who you are, and you're able to celebrate it amongst your own other peers of transgender, you know, other Fafafine. And we laugh at everything. We laugh at everything. And, you know, that's got to be great medicine for the heart, because that's a natural high. Like, that's just, you know, we sing, we dance, we entertain, you know, and it's just, you know, when you have, you know, that thing of just being able to laugh, you know?
Yeah.
It's an awesome thing. So, yeah.
So great to speak to you. I think our listeners will be really interested in the perspectives that you've shared. Thanks so much for joining us from Sydney, where you're at Mardi Gras.
Yeah, thank you.
I hope you have
thank you for having me on.
A great weekend.
Okay.
Enjoy the rest of the celebrations.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. I was speaking with Amoa, who's currently at Mardi Gras. She's a Fafafine and was talking about some of the differences, I guess, illuminating some of the differences between the Western transgender community and Fafafine, the support that exists and the strength of the Fafafine community.
I'm Sky Medusa, and you're listening to 24 Hours of Amazing Women on 3CR. Being an alternative model, we need more strong, sexy, diverse images of women out there in the media, and that's what I'm here to do.
I'm going to play a track called A Little by Nessie and Her Beard, who's a trans artist from the US, has some really, really amazing music online. Unfortunately, they're all pretty low-quality YouTube clips, and I wish I could see her in real life. Some wonderful, really charming songs, ukulele and keyboard and voice. So I'll play this one now for you, and then we'll get back to some interesting stuff, talking about God. And wrapping up this trans party hour. That was Nessie and Her Beard and a track called A Little Respect. There's a few things that I wanted to cover before we wrap up this trans party hour in about 5 minutes. One was this beautiful creation story by Kate Bornstein in her book, My New Gender Workbook. I guess it's a bit of an alternative to the story of Genesis that we're often taught. So I'll take a little reading from this. So it starts out, God is sitting there in heaven, having made nearly everything there is, including the heaven she's sitting in. He's made stars and oceans and planets and light and mountains and bunny rabbits and marijuana. She's even made a guy called Adam, who has a lovely time to himself in God's most perfect world. But after a few years, Adam says he's lonely, and God thinks to himself, something's missing. Being God, no sooner does he pose himself a problem, he solves it. God gets the bright idea to create a woman named Lilith, who's a hot babe, because this is one smart God, and Lilith is one hot butch top. Lilith pushes Adam down on the ground, and boy howdy, she rides that cowboy. Well, cool as God is, way back in those days, he's not having any part of that. Most people don't know the next part, but God has it in the back of her mind to make Adam another guy. He's all for mixing things up. But right now, God has to handle the Lilith situation, so he turns Lilith into a demon and creates Eve. Eve is also a hot babe. But God doesn't make the same mistake twice. Unlike Lilith, God makes Eve cute and with a little more bottom and a little naive to boot, which is how nearly all femmes are seen to this very day. Cute but dumb. Gah. Okay, stuffy as she is, back in those days, God really loves Adam and Eve. She loves them with all his heart. And remember, this is God's heart, so it's really big. And she loves them with all of it. He says to them, look what I made for you. It's a beautiful garden. There's everything you could possibly want to make yourself happy with. There are birds and waterfalls and lily pads and chipmunks. And over there, there's a whole acre of marijuana. All of this is yours, God continues, when Adam and Eve finally manage to quiet down their excitement at the idea of chipmunks and lily pads. All I want is your happiness. I've created harmony and you are part of it. So you get to do anything you want, anything at all, except one thing. There's one exception. Adam and Eve look at each other nervously. God continues reassuringly, you can do anything, touch anything, play with anything. Heck, you can even F anything. God pauses and looks down at his shoes and kicks the dirt from her toe. Then he continues in a slow, rumbly God voice, there is just one exception. Do not eat the fruit from that tree. She lifts another godly finger and points to an awesome tree. No, really, it is an awesome tree. It changes colour every time you look at it. Every time you blink, that tree changes colour. It is silver and gold, then red and blue. There were always two colours, of all of God's infinite colours. That tree even turns itself into black and white. Only one thing stays the same about the tree. It is always cloaked in two colours that are the exact opposite from one another. Red and blue, cool and warm, bright and dull. That's a really cool tree, says Adam. What's it called? Yeah, it's so pretty, says Eve. And the fruit looks delicious. Did I mention the fruit? Some people think it was an apple. I say the fruit of the tree was an apple would be like saying the Taj Mahal was a no-tell motel, which in fact it was, only with fancier architecture. So maybe, yes, maybe the fruit looks like an apple, but oh, what a scent it has. What a taste it has. It's sweet and sour at the same time. That fruit smells at once sun-kissed and rain-washed. The fruit from that tree always tastes like two opposite tastes and smells like two opposite smells. Nothing else like that exists in the garden. Everything else just is what it is. This tree is a true wonder. It's called the tree of knowledge of good and evil, mutters God. And if you know what's good for you, don't eat the goddamn fruit. Of course, Eve doesn't know what's good for her because she hasn't eaten the fruit yet. So it's really easy for a sexy, attractive serpent to seduce her into taking a great big bite of that delicious fruit, the fruit from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And because Eve is so gosh darn cute, Adam is an easy mark to take the next bite, and that's exactly what he does. And once they swallow, the two of them blink and look at each other. You're a man, says Eve. You're a woman, says Adam. It's hot today, says Eve. Yes, it's always either hot or cold,
agrees Adam. I'm happy, says Eve. I'm sad, Adam replies. You're naked, says Eve. Right, we're clothed or we're naked, says Adam. And it's bad to be naked, gasps Eve. We'd better get dressed so we can be good, agrees Adam. Well, the two of them scramble to find some clothes. They find two medium-sized fig leaves. Fig leaves, really? Well, you know the rest. God finds them out. He's heartbroken. She casts them out of the garden with a whole lot of curses. And for the rest of time ever since then, humanity has been looking at a world in terms of two and two only choices. Right or wrong, good or evil, young or old, black or white, rich or poor, man or woman, sane or insane, homo or hetero, smart or stupid, and on and on and on and on. But there's a happy ending. Hundreds of years later, God uses a flood to reboot life on Earth. That's when God gave us the rainbow to remind us that there's more than either or. That's the end of our Bible lesson for today. You've been listening to the Trans Party Hour, and next up we have Freedom of Species. Thanks for joining me today, Lisbeth.
Thanks for having me.
It's been great.
You're listening to 3CR, Happy International Women's Day. My name is Marietta, and on behalf of myself and the Royal House community, I'd like to send a big cheer to all the amazingly talented, absolutely fabulous women I know and those I'm yet to meet. Keep doing your thing and making a difference. Celebrating diversity and difference among women is my passion, my thing. Cheers to you all. Heels on, chest out, source on, and change the world.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.